headlines this hour. Iran's president says events in Afghanistan in the past two decades are a clear manifestation of aggression and human rights violation. The Russian president, Vladimir Putin, says that the United States' 20-year campaign in Afghanistan had zero results and ended in, quote, only tragedies, only losses. Also coming up, the Palestinian Health Ministry says that Israeli troops shot and killed a Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says that events that unfolded in Afghanistan during the past two decades serve as a concrete manifestation of aggression and human rights violations there. Raisi said, to grasp an idea of the situation in Afghanistan, one needs to look at the number of civilians, including women and children, killed or injured since the U.S. invasion of the country. The Iranian president underlined that the impoverished nation has witnessed, quote, a silent catastrophe while under the U.S. occupation. Raisi said the history of the U.S. military presence in other countries also shows that they not only failed to boost security, but undermined prevailing calm and stability. The president said Americans who should be answerable to their dismissal rights record to the public are just searching for pretexts to tarnish images of other countries over human rights. The Russian President Vladimir Putin says 20 years of U.S. presence in Afghanistan has ended in, quote, only tragedies, only losses. Putin was addressing students in the Russian city of Vladivostok. He said that the U.S. Army tried to impose their norms in Afghanistan for two decades. However, he added that it was a futile practice that resulted in the losses for Americans and more for the Afghan people. The Russian president stressed that it is impossible to impose anything on a nation from the outside. He also criticized Western countries' efforts to place Afghan refugees in Central Asian states. Russia argues that militants could enter the region under the guise of refugees. Political commentator Greg Summons says that the U.S. and its allies failed to impose the Western form of democracy on the Afghan nation through military means.
Many Western politicians and commentators are less willing to make this idea that by spreading democracy and these kinds of things by military means, it's quite Orwellian, and it sort of underlies the failure of the whole system, because it's coercing a people, a country, to accept values and norms which are completely alien to them at the barrel of a gun. If you look, the same people in charge that have been doing these for years, including Joe Biden himself, I mean, he's had a solid history of voting for U.S. wars of aggression. So I think this is not a radical changing of their stance and their attitude, but rather a rebalancing, because the U.S. is a waning force in the globe. So they need to prioritize where they put those financial, military, and political resources, because they don't have as much as they had previously.
Qatar has urged the Taliban to ensure safe passage of those Afghans who want to leave the country after the end of evacuations of American and other foreign forces there.
We stress on the Taliban the issue of freedom of movement, that there be safe passage for people to leave and enter if they want. We hope to see these commitments fulfilled in the near future, when the airport begins operations again, and that it happens smoothly, and that there be no obstacles for anyone wanting to leave or come to Afghanistan.
The Qatari foreign minister made the remarks in a joint press conference with his visiting Dutch counterpart. More than 123,000 foreign nationals and Afghans were evacuated from Afghanistan in a frenzied airlift operation to meet the August 31st deadline. But many more Afghans are desperate to depart. U.S. officials have said the Kabul airport is in a bad condition, with much of its basic infrastructure degraded or destroyed. Qatar hosted negotiations between the Taliban and the U.S. in recent years and was a transit point for about 43,000 evacuees from Afghanistan. The German foreign minister has met the Pakistani officials in Islamabad to discuss the situation in Afghanistan. The visit of Heiko Maas came hours after the U.S.-led foreign forces ended their 20-year war in Afghanistan. Kamran Youssef has the details.
The German foreign minister is the first top diplomat from a European country to visit Islamabad after Kabul fell to the Taliban. Heiko Maas arrived in the Pakistani capital hours after the U.S. forces ended their 20-year war in Afghanistan. The situation in the war-torn country was the main talking point during talks between the German and Pakistani foreign ministers. Pakistan, that shares a 2,600-kilometer-long border with Afghanistan, is concerned about the further instability in its neighboring country. The Pakistani foreign minister has this message for the world to avert yet another crisis in Afghanistan.
This is a pivotal moment in Afghanistan's history. The international community must remain engaged. Humanitarian assistance must flow. Do not let the economic collapse in Afghanistan take place.
But the German foreign minister linked the future cooperation with the Taliban living up to the promises they have made with the international community.
It is important for us that all Afghans, even those who do not support the Taliban, feel represented by this government, and it remains to be seen whether the Taliban take this into account.
Germany was part of the US-led alliance in Afghanistan, and hence the German foreign minister was asked what lessons the West should learn from their defeat in Afghanistan.
During the press conference, the German foreign minister conceded that the experiment to impose a specific form of government through military intervention was unsuccessful in Afghanistan. For him, the lesson for the West is that military intervention is not suited if it is meant for exporting and imposing a certain system on the foreign soil.
As the US finally ended its military campaign in Afghanistan, there are questions now about the future of Afghanistan. The Taliban may be celebrating the victory over the US, but their real test has only begun. Kamran Youssef, Islamabad.
The Taliban have called on their opposition group in the Panjshir Valley to lay down their arms as fighting continues over the control of the mountainous terrain. A senior Taliban official asked the people of Panjshir to stop their resistance, adding that the area has been surrounded by Taliban forces. He also said that the group has tried to negotiate for peace, but to no avail. Former Defense Minister Bismillah Mohammadi said that the Taliban had launched a renewed offensive on Tuesday night, but were forced to retreat with heavy casualties. People in Panjshir continue to defy the Taliban's calls for surrender.
And with the Taliban, they should put their weapons down. War, occupation, force were never a solution for this country and never will be. In case they want to enter Panjshir with force, they will take this pipe dream to their graves.
We are from the Popular People's Movement. Our message to the Taliban is that the gates of peace are open to them. Our gates are open to the Taliban for peace. If they make peace with us, we have no problems with any of them. If God forbid they attack Panjshir, each and every one of us from Panjshir will defend all of Afghanistan. We defended it during the era of the Russians, the era of the British, the previous era of the Taliban. We will defend all of Afghanistan and will continue to defend it.
The National Resistance Front in Panjshir is leading the fight against the Taliban. It consists of militiamen and former Afghan security forces. The group is headed by Ahmad Massoud, son of the late anti-Soviet Mujahideen commander Ahmad Shah Massoud. Panjshir has a long history of resistance. The region neither fell to the Soviets during the 1980s nor to the Taliban during their previous rule. The Iranian army has unveiled dozens of domestically manufactured military equipment. Authorities say that the move is aimed at boosting Iran's capability in electronic defense. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Meet Alborz, Iran's latest long-range radar that can detect any hostile aerial object in any given altitude. The Iranian domestically developed radar can track 300 targets at the same time, within a range of 450 kilometers. The high-tech equipment was unveiled on the occasion of the National Air Defense Day.
Alborz radar system is produced by our experts in Iran. It is capable of tracking any air target in high, medium, and low altitudes. Nothing can escape from this powerful radar, and even radar-evading aircrafts would be caught in the net of this advanced new radar.
Alborz radar was unveiled along with over 80 other indigenously built military hardware. Iran says the new equipment will significantly boost Iran's capability in electronic defense. And this, they say, was achieved despite all-out sanctions imposed by the U.S. against Iran's defense sector.
Despite all the restrictions and sanctions imposed on our country over the past four decades, we have managed to turn the threats into opportunities and build up our own arms arsenal. And the wide range of military hardware that you witnessed today are a result of the pressures imposed on us by our enemies.
The National Air Defense Day marks the formation of the Islamic Republic of Iran's air defense as a separate force in 2008, when it split from the country's air force. The military force says it possesses all the essential arms needed to defend Iran's skies, and 100% of the equipment, they say, are made indigenously.
Iran's air defense says the country's skies are safer than ever with its homegrown military equipment. Officials here say they owe this to four decades of U.S.-led arms embargoes that have prompted Iran to stand on its own feet and become self-sufficient in the defense industry. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Israeli troops have shot dead a Palestinian in the occupied West Bank overnight. The Palestinian Health Ministry has confirmed the deadly shooting without providing further details. The victim is reportedly a 39-year-old man who lived in a village near the city of Ramallah. Villagers say that there were disturbances or clashes in the area at the time of the shooting. They say that the slain Palestinian was returning from work when Israelis shot and killed him. Mona Kandil says Israeli forces killed the man as he was passing through a checkpoint.
The Palestinian martyr had Jerusalem Al-Quds documents because Palestinians who are originally from Al-Quds hold Jerusalem IDs, Israeli-issued IDs, so he has the right to move freely from the villages and from the occupied West Bank to the lands that were occupied in 1948, Al-Quds, as well as inside Israel. However, the Israeli forces were standing at the checkpoint, and then they opened fire when they saw him entering from the western entrance of the village of Beit Awr al-Tahta. Palestinians condemned the killing of this Palestinian man in cold blood. Hamas movement issued a statement calling for the Palestinians not to stop the different forms of resistance, saying that Palestinians will continue their struggle against the Israeli occupation.
The third wave of coronavirus is surging through the Gaza Strip. Daily COVID-19 infections have been rising over the past few days. The impoverished enclave lacks many resources to combat the coronavirus pandemic due to the crippling Israeli blockade in place since 2007. Bashar Shannon has more details.
The Gaza Strip has entered a third COVID wave, with over 1,300 new infections being discovered daily. Infections include the extremely dangerous Delta variant. People in the blockaded enclave are flocking to vaccination centers every day to get their coronavirus shots. The recent surge in infections and death is threatening to overwhelm hospitals weakened by years of Israeli blockade and wars. On Tuesday, over 30,000 Gazans received their COVID-19 vaccinations.
Initially, we didn't have vaccines, and soon after they arrived in the Gaza Strip, people, including myself, were afraid to get the vaccination jab. I now believe that the vaccines are safe and everyone must get inoculated in order to protect themselves and protect their families.
COVID-19 has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the impoverished coastal sliver, threatening the socioeconomic welfare of people in Gaza as much as their health.
Everyone must get the vaccine because this pandemic is deadly and has taken its toll on all humanity. I call on everyone to receive the vaccination jabs for the sake of their families.
Currently, there are some 12,000 active coronavirus cases in the Gaza Strip. UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, has played a major role in providing the blockaded enclave with badly needed coronavirus vaccines.
UNICEF has been providing vaccinations to the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, and we work with the Ministry of Health and other organizations to help reach herd immunity. Over the past few days, we were able to vaccinate some 95,000 people in Gaza, which is a great achievement.
The weakness of the healthcare system makes Gaza's population highly vulnerable to further major outbreaks of the deadly pandemic.
Rights groups say Israel's illegal practices continue to compound the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians living in the blockaded coastal strip. The measures, they say, are making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly virus. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
French President Emmanuel Macron has once again caused deep offense after attacking Islam on social media. Following a weekend tour of Iraq, Macron conflated Islam with the Daesh while simultaneously stealing full credit for the group's defeat. Rob Carter reports from London.
French President Emmanuel Macron has again caused serious offense to Muslims over the weekend by issuing controversial remarks conflating Islam to extremism and the terrorist actions of notorious Takfiri group Daesh. The comments published during a state visit to Iraq claimed that even though France defeated Daesh, the battle against Islamic terrorism isn't over.
He just can't seem to help himself. Even during a trip which was meant to smooth over damaged relations between France and the Muslim world, Macron again attacked the very religion which its adherents both played the biggest role in defeating the terrorist organization, but also suffered the most at its hands.
Robert Carter, London.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Like the U.S. wars in Vietnam and Iraq, Bush's invasion of Afghanistan was unlawful and led to the commission of torture and targeting of civilians, which constitute war crimes. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Marjorie Kahn, journalist. This article is published under the heading, As Biden Threatens More War, Don't Forget Afghanistan Invasion Was Illegal. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The United States has lost the war it started illegally. But as U.S. troops leave Afghanistan, the Biden administration continues to kill and promises to persist in killing Afghan people. 20 years of the U.S. war and occupation in Afghanistan cost at least $2.26 trillion and resulted in the deaths of more than 2,300 Americans and tens of thousands of Afghan civilians. The so-called War on Terror George W. Bush launched with his Operation Enduring Freedom has included the torture and abuse of untold numbers of people in Afghanistan, Iraq, Guantanamo, and the CIA black sites. It has exacerbated right-wing terrorism in the United States and provided the pretext for the surveillance of Muslims and those who dissent against government policy. And whistleblowers who expose U.S. war crimes have been rewarded with prosecutions under the Espionage Act and lengthy prison sentences. We must not forget the illegality, death, and destruction that the war in Afghanistan has caused over the decades, lest Americans repeat their lethal mistakes. Like the U.S. wars in Vietnam and Iraq, Bush's invasion of Afghanistan was unlawful and led to the commission of torture and targeting of civilians, which constitute war crimes. All three of those wars caused the deaths of thousands, even millions of people, cost trillions of U.S. taxpayer dollars, and devastated the countries of Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. The Bush administration began bombing Afghanistan on October 7, 2001, less than 1 month after the September 11, 2001, attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. As explained at the time, the U.S.-led NATO invasion of Afghanistan violated the United Nations Charter, which does not permit the use of military force for retaliation. The Charter mandates that countries settle their disputes peacefully using diplomatic means. But the United States repeatedly rejected diplomatic attempts at peaceful resolution. On October 15, 2001, the Washington Post reported, President Bush rejected an offer from Afghanistan's ruling Taliban to turn over suspected terrorist mastermind Osama bin Laden to a neutral third country, as an 8-day of bombing made clear that military coercion, not diplomacy, remains the crux of U.S. policy toward the regime, unquote. The bombing of Afghanistan was not legitimate self-defense under the charter because of Afghanistan not attacking the United States on September 11, 2001. The 9/11 attacks were crimes against humanity, not armed attacks by another state. The hijackers were not even Afghans. 15 of the 19 men came from Saudi Arabia. Moreover, there was not an immediate threat of an armed attack on the U.S. after September 11th. Or the United States would not have waited nearly a month before initiating its bombing campaign. Although the Security Council had passed resolutions 1368 and 1373, neither authorized the use of force in Afghanistan. Those resolutions condemned the 9/11 attacks, ordered the freezing of assets, criminalized terrorist activity, mandated the prevention of terrorist attacks and the taking of necessary steps to prevent the commission of terrorist activity, including the sharing of information, and urged the ratification and enforcement of the international conventions against terrorism. The U.S. failure to commit to multilateralism, the cornerstone of international law at the heart of the U.N. Charter, is a fundamental flaw of U.S. policy in Afghanistan. Since the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court did not come into effect until 2002, the crimes against humanity perpetrated on 9/11 should have been prosecuted in domestic courts under the well-established doctrine of universal jurisdiction, which allows countries to prosecute foreign nationals for the most heinous of crimes. And the Security Council could have established a special tribunal for 9/11 attacks like it did in Yugoslavia and Rwanda. But the United States-led invasion of Afghanistan was illegal. the illegal invasion and occupation of Afghanistan and resultant war on terror led to the commission of war crimes, including torture and targeting civilians. Bush administration instituted a widespread program of torture and abuse. A 2014 report of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence documented the use of waterboarding, which constitutes torture and other enhanced interrogation techniques. Detainees were slammed into walls, hung from the ceiling, kept in total darkness, deprived of sleep, sometimes with forced standing for up to 7.5 days, forced to stand on broken limbs for hours on end, threatened with mock execution, confined in a coffin-like box for 11 days, bathed in ice water and dressed in diapers. On March 5, 2020, the International Criminal Court, ICC, ordered a formal investigation of U.S. and Taliban officials for war crimes, including torture, committed in the so-called War on Terror. The ICC prosecutor found reasonable grounds to believe that, pursuant to a U.S. policy, members of the CIA had committed war crimes. They included torture and cruel treatment and outrages upon personal dignity, rape, and other forms of sexual violence against people held in detention facilities in Afghanistan, Poland, Romania, and Lithuania. During the Obama administration, prisoners held at Guantanamo were force-fed, which amounts to torture. Obama's use of drones to kill people in 7 different countries violated the UN Charter and the Geneva Conventions. Donald Trump conducted airstrikes in Iraq and Syria that killed record numbers of civilians, also in violation of the UN Charter and the Geneva Conventions. As Biden completes the withdrawal of troops in Afghanistan, his administration continues to kill people there. Nevertheless, on August 27th, Biden retaliated with a drone strike that apparently killed an ISIS-K planner, even though there was no evidence so far that he was involved in the suicide bombing near the airport recently. The U.S. Central Command released a statement that said, "We know of no civilian casualties from the U.S. drone strike, but according to The Guardian, an elder in Jalalabad reported that 3 civilians were killed and 4 were injured in the U.S. drone strike." The United States must completely refrain from using military force in Afghanistan.
We tried to get close to whom Imam al-Hussein actually is.
Verily, in the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, there is a warmth in the hearts of the believers that will never cool off.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam sees that the evil system is starting to institutionalize itself.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein. Ya Habibi, Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
There are a few qualities that are demonstrated by Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas in Karbala, that remembering Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas will help us, especially with that connection. I don't know if I can get this across. Some of you probably already have this. It's just a reminder for those of us who already have this. For others, maybe it's something we can think of. When you have an emotional, spiritual connection with someone that you look up to, someone you love, and they represent certain qualities There's a time you talk about those qualities and you want to try to have those qualities in you. You put an effort in that. It has benefits. You are going to be able to make some accomplishments. But when those qualities are difficult to accomplish, very difficult to implement, it requires something more than just knowing that these are good qualities. One of those things that can be very helpful is that bond with someone like a great shaheed, like Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. When you develop that bond with him, you like him, then you look at these qualities and we don't misrepresent him. Sometimes the descriptions, the way he is spoken of, although it's not a lie, some of the things that have been said, but that's not what makes Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. True, Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas was Qamaru Bani Hashim. He had a very attractive appearance. That's what that means, Qamaru Bani Hashim. Apparently, that's what it means. However, that's not what makes Abbas who he was. What makes Abbas who he was is the qualities that he earned, the personality he created in himself, what he manifested in Karbala and Ashura with Imam al-Hussein. These are very important qualities. If we have that connection with Abbas, seeing these correct qualities in him, every time we remember him, we cry for him, it increases that want, that desire to be like him. And I'll push myself more and more. No matter how difficult it is, as soon as I remember Abbas and him doing this, it just gives me that much more energy to move in that direction. What are these qualities that are so important, so difficult many times to find? One of the qualities of Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas, which is not seen as much, and when mentioned perhaps is not like some of the other qualities, attributes that we hear of, that we find so appealing, so attractive. But if we understand what this is, we'd realize and it would cause us to look at Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas on a different level. One quality is the quality of basira, the quality of insight. Basira is to understand what the conditions are and to behave based on them, not misunderstand the conditions. The enemy is trying to do one thing. You've got to read that. You have to understand that. You need to know what your course of action is going to be in a way where you don't fall in their trap, you don't do what they want, and you don't let them accomplish what they want. This is one of the most important parts of Basira. How do we attain that? Al-Fadl al-Abbas shows us this complete obedience to Imam al-Hussein. With that comes that insight. Again, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives knowledge. Insight, basira, is something that God gives. That if you obey Allah, what will you get? Nuran yamshi bih. You get this light that you walk with. This is basira. You have a flashlight. You have not a flashlight, a small little light. You have big floodlights that you can illuminate in the darkness and see everything before you, where it's hidden to everybody else. The plots of Muawiyah were hidden to people. The abilities of Yazid are hidden to people. The conditions of the Ummah are hidden to many. This person opens his eyes. Abul Fadl al-Abbas is seeing very clearly. Why? Obedience of Allah, obedience of Waliullah, obedience of Imam al-Husayn. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives them this bright light to see. This is basira. This is one of the qualities of Abbas, that whatever you hear about the battlefield, the decisions that were made about bringing water, dealing with water, dealing with the enemies in getting that water, dealing with going or not going towards the tents when he has or doesn't have that water. All of this is the result of this light that he has with him, that he can see clearly what must be done now. When should I ask Hussein to go? When should I call him Ya Akha Adrik Akhak? When should I call him Mawla? Every bit of what Abul Fadl Abbas does is clear to him. This is what Allah wants. Based on what? God gave him a light that he could see. Why did God give him that light? Al-Muti' lillah. Because whatever God showed him, he took that, he obeyed. There are many other qualities that Abul Fadl al-Abbas has, and I'm sure each of you, all of us, I'm nobody, I don't understand anything, and all of us should look at that great figure. There's a reason why we have a ziyarah for him. We need to look up to him. He's mentioned so much. Try to look at him in this way. As a follower of the Ma'soom, learn from him what he accomplished. And then the more we love him, the more you love Hussein. The more you get close to him, the closer. He's the gateway to Hussein, isn't he? You've heard this. Babul Hussein. Why? Because of this. If you look at him independently, if you don't see him as a shadow of Hussein, if you don't see him as walking in the footsteps of Hussein, you can't learn this from him. Ya Hussein, Ya Habib, Ya Hussein, Ya Habib, Ya Hussein, Ya Habib, Ya Hussein, Ya Habib.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In the limelight. The presence of extremist militant groups in Africa is providing the perfect pretext for expanding the U.S. military footprint there. The U.S. desperately needs new leadership before it bleeds another generation in an endless war. We now present you an article written by Brandon J. Weichert, the author of Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower. The piece is titled Afghanistan Today, Africa Tomorrow, America's Saga of Failure. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. And heartbreaking images from Kabul prove the Americans have lost the war. This just a few short years after they lost Iraq. Like it did in Iraq in 2003, the United States went after extremist militants in Afghanistan, but it hung around for 20 years trying vainly to remake ancient Afghanistan into a protectorate of the United States. Rather than ask why these conflicts resulted in staggering defeats for the United States, America's bipartisan ruling elite appear interested only in whitewashing these catastrophic failures by switching the focus now to Africa. The U.S. is barely out of Afghanistan. Its failure is so pronounced that it is leaving many of its own citizens in that country to the tender mercies of the Taliban. And many in Washington are already seeking to replicate the pattern of failure that resulted in America's profound defeat in Afghanistan in Africa. In 2017, as the Donald Trump administration was settling into what would become a chaotic presidency, the 33rd Joint Land, Air and Sea Strategic Special Program was conducted, which included 148 students from the U.S. military's various war colleges. The war game scenario was set in the period from 2023 to 2026. It detailed a coordinated terrorist attack on the New York and New Jersey ends of the Lincoln Tunnel, killing 435 people and injuring an additional 618. A cyber attack against a nuclear power plant in Berwick, Pennsylvania, occurs as well. There are also several follow-on attacks conducted against targets throughout Africa, the Canadian embassy in Mauritania, and suicide bombings in Nigeria. It is soon determined that Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM, is responsible for the coordinated, sophisticated wave of terrorist attacks. It should be noted that Boko Haram today is far more dangerous than Al-Qaeda in Maghreb or AQIM, though this is a distinction without much of a difference. Under the metrics of the war game, the fictional 46th president of the United States, an unconventional politician whose presidency is buffeted by a seemingly endless string of crises, commits the United States to a massive military response directed against Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM in Mauritania. This fictional president is as much a stand-in for America's current bombing president, Joe Biden, as it was for the tumultuous former president, Donald Trump. In the war game from 2017, the U.S. president promises resolve and a well-planned short conflict meant to decimate AQIM. Instead, just as with Afghanistan, Iraq, and countless other counterinsurgency wars, the Americans get bogged down for years after the initial invasion in 2023. Just as U.S. servicemen and women experienced in Iraq and Afghanistan, the fighting with Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM, is not constrained to the national boundaries of Mauritania. It transcends that nation and encompasses the neighboring countries of Mali and Algeria. And just as Iraq in 2003 became a magnet attracting the extremist militants from the so-called Greater Middle East, the U.S.-led fight against Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM, attracts militants from around the world. The U.S.-led coalition in Mauritania eventually becomes stymied by the transnational nature of the war, just as the real-world coalitions were in both Afghanistan and Iraq. The destructive pattern of those two failed wars repeat again when, in 2025, the Americans try to hand off the war to the locals, in this case the African Union, and it goes as disastrously wrong as the other wars did. The longer the war drags on with the U.S. and allied forces directly involved, the more diffuse the terrorist threat becomes. Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM's success against the Americans, reinvigorates Boko Haram, just as American intervention in Iraq propagated Daesh terrorists, al-Nusra terrorists, and a host of other Takfiri terror groups throughout the wider region. The war is inconclusive, and by 2026, U.S. allies are withdrawing, and Washington is yet again at a terrible crossroads. Does it double down on failure and ensure the endless war, this time in West Africa, drags on for decades longer? Or does it suffer another humiliating defeat at the hands of extremist militants? Don't you think this is on America's plate after Afghanistan? Just look at the last few months of the Biden administration. Over the summer, President Biden ordered the largest strike against militants of Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Further, as he was rightly taking flak for this horrific evacuation plan in Afghanistan, Joe Biden took to the airwaves to insist that the real fight in the so-called global war on terror was no longer in Afghanistan and West Asia. Instead, Biden argued, the center of gravity in the war has now shifted to Africa. Beyond that, the Biden administration's shadow president, Susan Rice, cut her teeth in Africa policy. The region has been an area of great concern for Susan Rice for years. What's more, over the past decade, the U.S. foreign policy establishment has been concerned by the growth of Chinese power and influence in the African continent. More recently, the head of U.S. Africa Command, or AFRICOM, has fretted over the rise of Russian groups throughout Africa. Washington has become awash with experts insisting that the U.S. is losing Africa to its rivals, and the presence of Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or AQIM, and other extremist militant groups provides the perfect pretext for expanding America's military footprint there, especially as the graybeards in Washington seek to shift the narrative from Afghanistan. While the threat of extremist militants in Africa is indeed growing, and both Chinese and Russian influence in Africa relative to that of the United States is troubling, Joe Biden and his team must avoid the siren song of military intervention in Africa. Although the fact that the U.S. security state has been preparing for an Afghanistan in West Africa with the presence of Africa hawks like seasoned rice being nestled inside the Biden administration, it is more than likely that soon the United States will be as committed to nation-building in West Africa as it was in both Afghanistan and Iraq, with similarly disastrous consequences. The U.S. desperately needs new leadership before it bleeds another generation in an endless war.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. What is the use of crying and mourning the martyrdom of Imam Hussein after 1400 years? The Quranic verses about the role of the infallible Imams are interpreted in three different ways. Wilayat is one of these interpretations. Your guardian can only be Allah and His Messenger, and those who believe, who establish worship and pay charity, and bow down in prayer. The Holy Quran, chapter 5, verse number 55. Another interpretation is submission and obedience. Obey Allah and obey the Messenger, and those in authority from among you. The Holy Quran, chapter 4, verse number 59. Friendship is the third interpretation. Say, I do not ask of you any reward for it, but love for my near relatives. The Holy Quran, chapter 42, verse number 23. What is this friendship? People are advised to accept their wilayat and obey them. But what is friendship for?
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. أنا لا تشان
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
This friendship is a kind of assurance. After the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, passed away, those who ended this friendship gradually brushed aside the leadership of the infallible Imams. In the absence of this sense of friendship, the Islamic Ummah will face the same disasters. Therefore, this sense of friendship is of paramount importance, and it can be achieved through this emotional connection to the infallible Imams. Narrating the tragedies that happened to them is an attempt to establish this emotional connection. Similarly, praising their virtues through the mourning ceremonies is another way to form this emotional bond. Therefore, it is necessary to hold the mourning ceremonies and narrate the events of Ashura. Some people should not adopt a so-called intellectual position and reject the necessity of these mourning ceremonies. These ceremonies are necessary, and they will always be necessary. Of course, some forms of mourning are unacceptable. For instance, Tatbir, a religiously prohibited ritual in which people cut their foreheads, has been declared haram, and it must not be practiced. That is because Tatbir will make the enemies more insolent and will give them an advantage over those who love the members of the Holy Prophet's household. But the common mourning rituals can increasingly strengthen one's emotional connection to the infallible Imams. These rituals are very good.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.